across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Now, I hope that everything is good with you. So far, the weather is nice, still in London, sunny, summery, quite warm, maybe getting hotter later in this week as I record this, which will be the second week in August already. Thank you again for the ongoing messages about my hearing issue. I'm doing what I've been told to do. I always wear, when I'm recording at home, level-protected headphones. And I've got another pair now that are even more aggressive in the way that they control the sound. And, you know, I'm just being careful. I'm taking the meds. I've got two kinds of pills to take. And I will be taking at least one of them for 2 months to help the recovery from this thing. But literally, scary, scary moment. And thank you very much for being so very kind in all of your responses to it and the things that you said to me. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, if you want a shout out on the show, if you have a question that you want answering, please let me know in the subject area of the email. All emails I get to see, all emails I read, the emails that require a response or an action, then I will act on. And because I'm a little behind on things at the moment, if you've been expecting anything, hasn't happened, please do remind me. It's been a difficult couple of weeks that I've been through. But hopefully, my fingers and everything else are crossed, I'm coming out of it now, which is good news. Okay, thank you very much to Adam, by the way, my webmaster. Just to mention, the cruise, which is happening from October the 28th, is ongoing. It is with TUI, they're providing the cruise, and I am hosting the events involving some of the biggest guests from The Unexplained. Complete Mediterranean experience with TUI Marella Cruises and one of their finest cruise ships from October the 28th. If you want to know more about it, please go to my special website, TheUnexplainedLive.com, which is separate from but connected with my main website, TheUnexplained.tv. So it's TheUnexplainedLive.com. Thank you very much. Okay, guest on this edition, it's going to be a slightly shorter podcast, this, but an interesting conversation that comes from my TV show, which was the last TV show before I had the recent problem that I had, which is why you haven't heard it before now. This is a man called Kenton Coole. He is one of the United Kingdom's most accomplished mountaineers, and he comes from a place in Berkshire where there are no mountains. But as you will hear, he is an expert on mountains like Everest and K2, two, of course, of the most difficult peaks in the world. There are many strange, unusual, and unexplained stories connected with climbing Everest, for one, but climbing all mountains. And even though this isn't strictly unexplained, so it's not strictly all about ghosts, and it's certainly not about UFOs, it's, I think, a very interesting conversation with a very interesting person. And, you know, on a very hot day, discussions of places that are snowy and sub-zero, they're actually quite comforting in a way. So that's what we're going to do on this edition of The Unexplained. Like I say, this is a shorter edition. I'm hoping to get things completely back on track in the next week or two. I'm just so far behind myself after what happened recently with the hearing incident that I'm going to take time to crank back fully into action. But this is a hugely interesting and very nice guy from my TV show, Kenton Coole, mountaineer. Let me introduce to you then Kenton Edward Coole, born in 1973, according to his biography, an English mountaineer and mountain guide, one of Britain's leading alpine and high-altitude climbers, has reached the summit of Mount Everest 16 times, according to this biography, including leading Serana Fine's 2008 and 2009 expeditions, which were notable in themselves. He's completed more than 20 notable expeditions in the greater ranges, and in 2013 became the first person to climb Nuptse, Everest and Lhotse in a single push without going back to base camp. Now, for most people, it's more than they could achieve to get up Everest, and for some, they'll get to the top. But to do three peaks, that's astonishing. Kenton, thank you very much for coming on.
No, my pleasure, Howard. You actually missed out that I was born in Slough.
I know. I think you and I have talked before on a radio station called Radio Berkshire years and years ago, and I was serving my time there, as they say. But, I mean, that was going to be my first question, and I'm sure you've been asked it a million times, probably by me the last time we spoke. You know, there are no mountains in Slough. I know it incredibly well, like the back of that hand. So how, being born and raised in Slough, very handy for Windsor, how do you become a mountaineer?
Well, it's quite close to Heathrow Airport, which is quite good, because we don't really have any big mountains in the UK. I mean, Ben Nevis is the biggest we got. That said, the Scottish Hills pack a big punch. But my humble beginnings were at Brunel University, at the climbing wall in the university, which at the time I was 17 years old. That climbing wall was state of the art. I'm not even sure it's there anymore. It used to be at the back of the... at the sports hall, and that's where it all began. Just climbing, bouldering, as we call it, on the wall at Brunel.
But I used to
tell you, there was hot in there.
Well, I can imagine what it might be like, you know, in the next 48 hours. Now, I used to do that, and of course, it's exciting to do it. You think, hey, look what I'm achieving, and you look down, and you know, you're however many feet up. But it's one thing to do that and think, I kind of like this, and another thing to think, I want to climb the great peaks. You know, how did you make that progression?
Well, I think no matter what we do, I mean, I used to be a hockey player, which was quite convenient living in Slough, because there's a numerous Indeed. Fantastic hockey teams around there. But no matter what we do, we kind of need a mentor or a hero or somebody that we can aspire to. You know, you've already referenced, I was born in 1973, puts me in a certain genre, pre-internet, if we can actually believe that. So it was books. That was our source of reference. And it was two climbers in particular. So Chris Bonington and Doug Scott. And they started rock climbing. And then very quickly, it was the Alps. It was the big mountains of the Himalayas. And for me, an impressionable young guy in Slough, leafing through these books, it was, wow, this is what I want to do. It was the obvious journey for me to embark on.
Even when, look, I read some of those books too, and I can always remember the images of those two aforementioned people. And they'd always have a lot of frostbite going on and a beard, usually a beard somewhat fringed in ice. I have to say I was humbled by it, but I was not inspired to do it.
Well, of course, I mean, inspiration comes from lots of different places, doesn't it? And the beards, well, the beards were certainly of the era. You see the pictures of them at one another's weddings. They've got these big beards. They'd be on trend now, certainly in places like Shoreditch. But yeah, it was, for me, it was mesmerizing. I was a Boy Scout, so I knew what camping was. And you know, maybe high altitude climbing is just a way to get to the most extreme campsites in the world. I don't know, but I didn't come from a climbing background, but there's something about climbing just grabbed me, and I literally just ran with it, and I have done all my career, and certainly don't regret a single moment or a single decision that I've made when it comes to climbing the big mountains. I love it. It's a sense of freedom.
I love your enthusiasm for it. And, you know, this show is The Unexplained, so we talk about a lot of things that are unusual and different and odd. Instances where people are perhaps pushed to the very limit and strange things happen to and around them. So we will talk about some of those things. Is the greatest challenge for a climber today, and I'm sure it was when you were a kid, but for a climber in 2022, is it still Everest?
No, I mean, it probably isn't. I mean, so Everest clearly is the biggest mountain in the world. First climbed in 53, as we all know. Tenzing Norgay and Sir Edmund Hillary climbed it back in 1953. And 99% of people that would climb that mountain every single year would climb one of two routes, the North Ridge, first climbed by the Chinese, or the East Ridge, first climbed by Hillary and Tenzing back in 53. But there are a myriad of really hard climbs on that mountain, which nobody ever attempts. So it's quite a hard one to say. There are harder climbs, definitely. I work in the industry. I commercially lead people to the top of Everest, people that don't necessarily have the experience, perhaps they don't necessarily have the technical capability. So I will look after them.
And do you guarantee to get them there?
I beg your pardon?
Do you guarantee to get them there?
No. I don't guarantee to. You can't guarantee anything in the Big Hills. So when I first... You know, our first touch point with the client, say, I'm not saying you do, but say you want to climb Everest, we might sit down and have supper in town, perhaps we even go to Slough, who knows.
Well, I feel you should.
Well, it's a great place to meet yourself.
Somewhat, exactly, as I've done. And you get their story.
I won't make a promise to you, but I say, okay, my job as a professional mountain guide is to bring you back through the front door. Now, whether we gain a summit along the way, that's great. But ideally, we're going to come home alive with 10 fingers, 10 toes, as friends, having had a great time. And if we gain a summit, well, that's the cherry on top of the icing. But none of it, honestly, none of it is a guarantee. I will train with you. I will go to other mountains. I will sort your nutrition, your fitness, your blah, 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 to a point that I think you have a legitimate chance of climbing Everest and getting back down. But there's no guarantees on that mountain. It's a dangerous mountain, no matter how commercial we make it, no matter how many Sherpas we use, how much oxygen we use. It's still dangerous. It's the highest point on the earth. We're not supposed to be there. So, and you know, the inherent danger.
Because people read books about this, and because they see people achieving these things, they kind of blind themselves to the fact that an awful lot of people die in the pursuit of getting. I mean, it must be a wonderful feeling to get to the top. I've watched films of people at the top. I'm sure it looks very different when you're actually there. You can tell me, but the films look pretty impressive. But the fact of the matter is, I checked up on statistics. If we think about Everest, more than 300 people have died, haven't they, trying to get there, to the top?
Yeah, but again, you've got to keep that into context. I forget what the number is these days. I think there's been close to perhaps even over 10,000 ascents by 7,000 people, because a number of people summit multiple times like I have. So when you look at it in the broader sense of things, 300 people compared with 7,000 people climbed it. And then if you look at the statistics, and you can make statistics tell you anything, a lot of those deaths, or the greater proportion of those deaths, would have occurred pre the commercial era that we're in today. That doesn't take anything away from it. This year, there was one death on Everest.
Right.
That's unusually low.
So that's normally because the equipment is better?
I beg your pardon?
The equipment is better, the training is better?
Yeah, the equipment's better, the understanding of the mountains better, the Sherpa teams are more professional, and above all, weather forecasting. That's arguably the biggest tool that we have these days, which they never had. Even 20 years ago, the weather forecasting was a bit so-so. But between the weather forecasting and experience and better Sherpa teams, you know, the local guys that we use who are the backbone, you know, the real heroes of the Himalayas, between all that, we can't safeguard someone's ascent. But, you know, we can be pretty sure that we're going to, you know, come home in one piece.
And we've got to say the technology is better. The weather forecasting, like you said, is better. Many things are on your side now, which means that fewer people die. But we haven't got to kid ourselves. And I think if you watch, you know, if you read magazines today or you look at TV programs, they make it kind of look like, oh, yes, I'm sitting back here with a mug of coffee. I think I'm going to get in touch with Kenton. And I think I was thinking about Ibiza next year, but I'm going to go to Everest. Actually, what we've got to remember is that even getting to the local airport is a major feat for the pilots who do it, isn't it? Even getting in there to Kathmandu is a huge thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kathmandu is considered one of the most dangerous international airports in the world. There's a terrible air crash back in the sort of mid-90s, which killed, there was a very prominent British climber, Mark Miller, lost his life in that air crash. And then from Kathmandu, you've got to get to Lukla, which is the start of the base camp trek. And Lukla is quite often heralded as the most dangerous airport in the world. Whether that's actually true or not, quite how they quantify that, I'm not sure. But it is seat of your pants. Your heart is definitely in your mouth. The runway is inclined at 15 degrees. There's a brick wall at the end of the runway. There's no margin for error, no instrument landing. It's
and you haven't even started climbing anything yet.
Part of the whole expedition.
I mean, you do that and you haven't even started climbing anything yet. So look, this is
petrifying.
Even in 2022, it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, you say that, but you've done it, what, 20 times or whatever it is. You know, I'm fascinated by all of this, but there is another aspect to this, and that is one of the reasons that we're talking tonight on a show like this one. I mean, number one, I love to have interesting people on, and you certainly tick that box with a great big gold tick. There is a lot of mystery around ascent of any of these mountains, but Everest in particular, because so many people have been in pursuit of that goal of getting to the top, and many people have died trying to get there, and many of their bodies remain upon the mountain. But there are many, many mysteries, people reporting unusual phenomena, assistance on the mountain from people who apparently do not exist but came to help them. I mean, there was a story that I was reading. I don't know whether I'm sure you'll know this one, and I hope you don't mind me quoting it to you. This was Dougal Haston and Doug Scott, two people who were always on the TV when you were a kid and when I was slightly older than you.
It would have been September 1975, the first British to climb the mountain on the Chris Bonington Everest expedition, which became known as Everest the Hard Way. And they were coming down from the summit and they had an impromptu bivouac and they run out of oxygen. And the talk is that there was a third person. It's the same story.
That's exactly the story. That they had some kind of phantom assistance.
Exactly. So the guys come down. It was a very heralded ascent. And the book actually was the inspiration for me to get into climbing. It was the first climbing book I ever read. And it was late in the day and they're coming down and they run out of supplementary oxygen, essentially the oxygen we carry in our oxygen tanks. And they get to the south summit. And they decide that what they're going to do, they're going to bivouac, which is spend the night out, which at the time, I think it was the highest ever bivouac survived. They didn't really have anything with them, so they dug into the snow. I think Doug Scott didn't even have a down suit. He just had a windsuit over the top of his thermopile, one-piece suit. And then they sat there throughout the night. They've got no stove, no food, no water, no oxygen. And they're massaging one another's feet to try to keep the circulation. And I think it was Doug Scott who writes about it. It was one of them, but I think it was Scott who writes about it, saying that he ended up having a conversation with a third party in the snow hole, quite an in-depth conversation. And he was absolutely adamant that this person was there answering him back. And they were having a dialogue which went on apparently for hours. And when they were both getting their things together in the morning to head back down to safety, they had a conversation that the two people who were actually there, Haston and Scott, and one of them said to the other one, "Were you aware of this person who was with us last night?" He's like, "Well, there's no one else there." And Scott was adamant that there was a third person there. And credits the third person for helping him get through the night without frostbite, no serious injuries at all. And that particular bivouac survival really triggered something in Doug Scott, that you could climb at super high altitude, you know, high 8,000 meter plus altitude without supplementary oxygen, and make the summits of these mountains.
If you have assistance from a phantom helper.
They'd all been climbed with oxygen.
But, you know, they afterwards, I mean, the account that I've got of this, and I'll quote it to you, Haston and Scott claimed the phantom climber helped them make it through the night, which is basically what I mean, that is an astonishing story, because technically before that event, as you said, a lot of people would have thought it wasn't possible to do what they did, but they did, and they thought that they had been helped. Now, I guess that leads to the question, and there are many other weird stories that we'll get into around Everest in particular. You know, could this be, by the time they're that high up and the conditions are that bad and you're that tired, you start seeing things?
Oh, 100%. So, I mean, I don't want to sort of pee-pee on anybody's mythical bonfire, but... Yeah, you're super high, you're dehydrated, you're physically tired, and then you run out of oxygen. And what oxygen does, it keeps us warm high on the mountain. But what happens to our brains when you remove oxygen, when you starve your brain of oxygen, your cognitive thought process disappears. So our ability to think rationally is very quickly inhibited. And you know, this is a classic case of hypoxia, where the brain is starved of oxygen, and you start having these internal dialogues with yourself, which actually don't. You know, there was clearly no.
To the extent of having hours of dialogue, though, that's the interesting thing.
Well,
isn't it?
Who knows? I mean, Doug Scott was quite famed for being quite partial to smoking things that perhaps he shouldn't be smoking. So I don't know whether that was.
I hear what you're saying.
I mean, the guy was a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. I knew him very well to his sad death about 2 years ago, it was. And one of the greatest climbers, you know, of all time. What he did was phenomenal.
And another one of those heroes, you know, with the frostbitten face and the beard.
Oh, 100%. Fringed by ice. I mean, what he did with Chris Bonington was beyond beyond measure. And Dougal Haslam himself, a phenomenal climber. There's controversy all around his career. Ended up living and working out of Lausanne in Switzerland and died in a very tragic avalanche, which most people said that he should have been well aware that it was an avalanche risk zone. He shouldn't have been there skiing on his own and all these things. So there's controversy, you know, from his time up in Scotland where he got involved in a hit and run accident, very sadly. I think he served time in prison for that. Battled a little bit with alcohol, but was, again, one of the most phenomenal, visionary climbers.
Colourful characters, but this...
Oh, my God, just a little
instance
bit.
Instance in 1975 is because of the detail involved in this. A lot of people would have got into that situation, I'm sure, and probably died.
They were
on the cusp of death, and they believed that there had been a dialogue with something or someone there that just happened to assist them in getting through the night.
Now, yeah, I mean, undoubtedly, most climbers would have died. There were some of the strongest climbers in the world at the time. Not only did they not die, but they had no frostbite. It was quite remarkable. You know,
how can that be, by the way? How do you come out of that without frostbite?
I think it just shows the strength of character that they had. The fact that they burrow into a snow cave, that's going to hugely help. But you don't need to look too far. Mm. Where they were was pretty much the same spot that Rob Hall made famous in the 1996 disaster, which was documented in Into Thin Air. I've spaced in the name of the author, but a very famous book which was made into the film. I think it was just called Everest. Rob Hall famously, on the radio to his wife as he's passing away in the eye of a storm. This was the same place. Admittedly, Haslam and Scott aren't in a storm, but they're out of oxygen. They've got rudimentary equipment. It's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Is it a mystery? Most people wouldn't have survived it, let alone come back with no frostbite.
So to that extent, although we don't know the full ins and outs of it, we never will, in all probability, because, as you say, the two principals are no longer with us. But what an astonishing story, of which there are many connected with Everest. Jamie, thank you very much. We were talking about television sets and the old CCTV ones, the ones with the glass tubes in them rather than a flat screen, which is what almost all TVs are now. Jamie tells me that he records this show every week on a VHS recorder, with the old tapes. Jamie, that's great. Is it SVHS or is it just standard VHS? Please let me know. I've got two VHS recorders. My colleagues will not be surprised by that because I have most things and it's deeply sad. Also, back to Chewy the dog and the saga of the dog who watches this show that James told me about. Apparently when I said the word Chewy, which is the name of the dog, he woke up. Okay, which apparently he doesn't do for James, but does for me. So he's gone back to sleep now. So should I do this? My producer's nodding. Yeah, let's do it. Okay, let's do this. James, are you ready? Okay, he's fast asleep. Is his little stomach going up and down? Okay, is he having doggy dreams chasing things? Let's just say, Chewy, come on, Chewy. Oh, good boy, Chewy. It's hotter than you think. Let's get back quickly to Kenton Cool, mountaineer and remarkable guy. Kenton, a lot of love for you coming in tonight. Doing what you do and what you've done with your life is just remarkable. I don't have words. I'm supposed to know words, but I don't have one that fits. Let's talk about some of the strange stuff that you have to deal with when you're climbing Everest. And I'm thinking here of something that I've seen depicted on some TV programs. A lot of TV programs don't go there. But the bodies of those who fall by the wayside, the ones who don't make it, who have to be left and ultimately freeze to death, or, they have insufficient oxygen to survive, they die on the mountain, or they die close to the top. They die somewhere on the route, and they have in their numbers, as we've said, for decades. These bodies litter the course, don't they, quite literally, going up, and sometimes the differing climatic conditions will reveal a body, yeah?
Yeah, it can do. So there's a number of quite renowned bodies on the mountain. And rather sadly, there's one now on the south side, which is very graphic, and you almost have to climb around this poor individual. He's currently positioned at the bottom of the what is known as the Hillary Step, the last little hard bit before the summit. So this is on the south side of Everest. He's an American climber. I believe his Christian name was Don. And it's, as I said, it's pretty graphic and in your face. You virtually have to step past this individual to continue your journey to the top. And I was there with my client this year, a lovely English girl who resides in the US now. And the fact that Don was there kind of slipped my mind. And we come around the corner, and there he is. He's kind of sat on his little rock perch. And it really unhinged Rebecca, which is really sad.
Well, I can completely relate to that. And because we have to say, because of the cold climatic conditions, you know, we know that cold temperatures preserve things. So presumably, if somebody, you know, comes a cropper, has a mischief, something goes wrong with their bid, and they end up sadly dying on the mountain, they will be preserved as in aspic.
I mean, his down suit, his goggles, gloved hands. Yeah, there's slight fading of his down suit, for instance. So you know that it's been there for a few years. I think he's been there since 2019. So what's that, 3 years?
But there are some from far, far before that, aren't there? And you know, the things that are preserved include
and not
hair.
Just on Everest, on many other mountains. And the K2, which is the second highest mountain in the world, when people die on that, they generally end up falling. And they have this gruesome tendency to pop out quite literally on the glacier much, much lower down a number of years later. So they would fall down, getting tombed on the glacier, and at some stage their remains are found a number of years later.
So the mountain gives up its dead?
To an extent, you could look at it that way. And then, like you say, climatic changes. Some years there's lots of snow, some years there is not so much snow, and depending how much precipitation there's been during the monsoon, it may cover bodies, or the wind might scour the snow away, and some bodies become revealed from their resting place.
And we have to say that ordinary people thinking about this would say, well, surely they have expeditions from time to time to remove the bodies. I've read about some, I know they do, but in the most part, it isn't possible, is it, to take them away?
It'd be very, I mean, you can't get a helicopter up to that sort of altitude. It would be very difficult to remove, certainly on the south side of Everest, anybody, you know, really above the balcony, to remove a body from above there would be extremely difficult. And of course, you put in a whole team, because you probably need a dozen people, something like that. And you're putting that team into danger, because, you know, they're climbing up into what we know as the death zone. Anything above 7,500 meters, you know, is an area of the atmosphere where we are just not supposed to live. And, you know, I've had this rather open, gruesome conversation with my family about it. You know, what happens to my body, and is it my choice, or is it the family's choice? And it's a very difficult one. It's very sensitive for obvious reasons. Some bodies do get removed, but they're generally lower on the mountain. Some get blown off. Some just disappear, because we only climb Everest in a very small weather window each year. It's normally only a handful of days that people can actually get to the summit. So the bodies that are you know, just beneath the summit, and you know, the bodies that you would encounter on summit day, where most of the bodies generally are, would only be seen for 4, 5, 6 days of the year, and the rest of the time, who knows what's happening up there with weather.
We understand the physical process that means that they are preserved in that way. We also understand why they cannot be removed, but as you said, utterly unnerving for people who experience that.
Totally.
In the pantheon of stories about Everest, there is the corpse of a climber they call Green Boots, and I think there are some myths and legends and stories about Green Boots. Have you heard those?
Yeah, so Green Boots is in a small cave on the north side of Everest. Now, I've not climbed on the north side. That's climbing up from the Chinese side, but he is a climber of some renown these days, unfortunately. Died in, I believe, 96. There's a big storm in 96 that killed a lot of people on the south side of Everest. And my understanding is Green Boots was an Indian climber. I'm not 100% sure. I think his exact identity is not 100% sure. Although a guy I used to work with, I remember once people refer to old Green Boots and he said, oh, people forget, you know, he was a climber on the Indian team that year and, you know, I knew him and things like that. So, and the Green Boots refers to the color of his climbing boots, and he's tucked into a cave and he's rather insensitively used as a landmark. And when people radio down their position, whether you're above or beneath old Green Boots, is used as a reference to where the climber is on the mountain.
And he is, like so many others,
it's become quite a waymark.
Preserved there, and you know, that I can understand why people would use, because where are they? I mean, you're not going to have road signs up there.
Just, yeah, it's often dark when you pass that climber on the way up. And then I think it was, I don't know, 2013, 12, 13, around there, a British climber got into difficulties, you know, in the same place, and ended up passing away, you know, in that same cave. A climber known as David Sharp, his name was. He got involved in difficulties. And then his possessions were brought back to the UK by...
So when you do this, wherever it is, you have to know that there is a chance that you're not going to make it. I think the odds are higher for K2, as I was reading them today, but, you know, there are odds there. Very quickly, sadly, we've only got 2 minutes. I've got a question from Sean, and I want to... There was a recent documentary about this, which, you know, piqued... I didn't know all the detail of this, but very famous climber, George Mallory.
George Mallory... 7th of June, disappeared.
Exactly. Tried to get to the top. We don't know whether he made it or not. His body, I don't think, was found until 1999. So, you know, that's how many 70 odd years he was completely vanished. And nobody is quite sure, is that right, whether he made the top or not?
It's the biggest mystery of Everest, arguably the biggest mystery of mountaineering. Andrew Irving, George Mallory, last seen by Odell, going strongly for the top. And then the clouds rolled in and they were never seen alive again. And the myth is there's a box camera. Mallory had a very early Kodak box camera, and everybody's trying to find Irving's body because the box camera was not found with...
And the camera might contain some evidence?
Exactly. Now, wow. You're going to love this, and there might just be time to tell you this. There is a conspiracy theory, and I know you're going to love it, but that the Chinese found the body in the mid-60s, Irving's body, and apparently they botched the development. It's a little known story. It only just came to light through a journalist climber called Mark Sinnott.
What a story. You left the best to last. Kenton Cool, thank you so much. I could spend 3 hours or more talking to you. Give my love to Slough, and thank you for helping me tonight.
My pleasure.
And a slightly shorter conversation, but what a truly interesting and brave man. Kenton Cool, accomplished mountaineer from Berkshire. And I could have spoken with him all night. What a guy. More great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained as I try to get things back to normal now. And thank you very much for all of your responses to the recent hearing issue. Onwards and upwards, like they say, through the summer, into the autumn, and towards the back end of 2022. Another year that's gone in the snap of a finger. So, until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.